It's Halsey with the Helicopter Podcast, and I hope you're enjoying listening to the podcast. But just to make sure that you are aware, if you would also like to watch the podcast, you can go to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast YouTube channel. We post all of our podcasts to video format there. We're also doing a lot of really cool things over there, like vlogs. We did a bunch of fun stuff at HAI, including in-person interviews with all these amazing people. So do me a favor, head over to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast. Hope you enjoy.
Thank you to our sponsor, Hillsboro Heli Academy. Embark on your helicopter pilot journey with Hillsboro Heli Academy. Known worldwide, they make it easy to achieve both U.S. and European helicopter licenses. Visit flyhaa.com to schedule your introductory flight and turn your dream into a career.
All right, feels like I'm somewhere very familiar. It looks a little different.
Yeah.
Little bit of a remodel, but being back in Troutdale, being here at Hillsboro Heli Academy, obviously back when I was here, still Hillsboro Aviation.
Yeah.
It feels very much the same. Actually, Zach and I were just talking when we're kind of walking around the halls. It's hard not to start reminiscing and then seeing all the students and the instructors, kind of the hustle and bustle. So just take me back. You know, I had a conversation with Max Lyons recently.
Yeah.
And he talked about selling the school, which is crazy. It's 10 years now.
Yeah.
Which doesn't, that just means that life is moving too quickly. But I'm just kind of curious to hear, during that transition, what did that all look like? What did that mean for the helicopter side specifically? And what have you guys done in the last 10 years to now get to this point where it's a beautiful facility, lots of really cool things in place? And just kind of walk me through the history of Hillsboro Heli Academy.
Yeah. So, you know, at first I think it was really difficult. The students always really loved seeing the turbines out front.
Sure.
Watching the 205 spin up. And so when Max, you know, took all the turbines and kept Hillsboro Aviation, and then we became Hillsboro Aero Academy, and then Hillsboro Heli Academy as the helicopter school. You know, it was a little bit difficult, I think. The students, I think, missed seeing those things spooling up
Sure.
in the morning and heading out to fires and things like that. But honestly, the focus, the ability to focus specifically on just the school aspect of the company has been just an amazing, amazing opportunity for us. You know, when you have different business ventures and you're going in different directions and you're looking at different things, sometimes that attention can get distracted a little bit.
Of course.
And I think the ability for us to focus solely on the student and just focus on training has been an amazing, amazing aspect of the transition 10 years ago.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, Max did a great job, but the flight school was just one faction of the business, a big faction, but just kind of being able to singular focus on one thing makes a lot of sense. You bring up this idea of back in my experience of Hillsboro and training is seeing the turbine helicopters. And in fact, I feel like the first time that I saw you, met you, I was new to line service. And I think you were flying the TV. Was it 106 TV?
Yeah. Right.
The Coin 6 helicopter. I remember that. That was neat for me because that was always something to aspire to, right? You kind of saw the next step. You saw the 22s and the R-44s, but then you saw on the far end of the ramp was always the turbines. So when I started school, you were already flying those aircraft. I'm just curious to hear a little bit of your background. What brought you into flight training and kind of to this point now?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. Of course, I did my flight training at this company. at the time, like you mentioned, it was Hillsborough Aviation. And always just really enjoyed it. Love the environment, love hanging out with other students and, you know, the family feel that you get being totally around the school. And then, you know, I took a little bit of a different route than a lot of people do. I actually became a second-in-command pilot, doing helicopter firefighting, logging, and things like that. And it's interesting, I had been with the company a while, and the chief pilot and I were discussing an upgrade to PIC and the S-61, getting my type rating. And one of the guys that I was flying with, the command pilot that I was flying with at the time, told me that I had to go back and become an instructor.
Okay.
And which was really hard, of course, flying an S-61, you know, living the dream. And then he said, no, you got to go back. You got to sit left seat in an R-22. That was hard to hear. And it's not that he was saying that, you know, I was missing something, but what he told me is the most valuable part of your pilot life is going to be as an instructor. So, you know, the interesting thing is he was probably one of the best pilots that I've ever flown with in my life. And so to have that kind of advice from someone that I looked up to and wanted to, you know, I wanted to fly like him. And so when he said, you know, I should come back and be an instructor, I thought, you know, if this guy's telling me this, I'm going to do it. And so I came back as an instructor. I actually came back to the school that I did my training at, became an instructor, and he was absolutely right. It was probably one of the most valuable aspects of my career, being an instructor in an R-22. And, you know, that kind of shaped me in a really interesting way and put a different value on this environment for me, not only as a school and how important it is to have good foundations and good beginnings, but also that aspect of, you know, using the opportunity as an instructor to better yourself and also help these guys achieve things and learn as much as they can while they're here.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, a lot of the questions that I get specifically during the podcast is, hey, I have an opportunity to go fly tours in a 44 or SIC similar.
Yeah.
But I also have an opportunity to be an instructor, but I'm kind of leaning towards the other way.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I feel like a lot of people kind of don't want to instruct. I think it's a level of anxiety. 200-hour sure. pilot, you know, blind leading the blind is a term that I've used commonly on the podcast. So I understand that, but I 100% agree because I've always equated it to me playing football. I was a decent football player, but when I started coaching football and I started seeing the same mistakes that my coaches used to tell me that I was making, but I couldn't recognize it in the moment, it just all made sense to me. And that's what flight instruction was for me.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, now I get it. Now I see the nose dropping.
That's right.
In
that's
an auto rotation yeah. because the student's eyes are peeled to the, you know, the tack.
Yeah.
It just is like a light bulb.
Yeah.
And so you're actually not doing a ton of hands-on flying, but you become such a better stick.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm curious to, though, go back to this SIC idea because it's something I'm very unfamiliar with. I've actually never flown in a two-pilot environment.
Yeah.
At that time, obviously, did you have your CFI or did you go straight to commercial to SIC?
No, actually, crazy enough, I got hired on as the SIC with 101 hours of PIC time. So it was pretty wild experience. The only aircraft I had ever flown was the R-22. And, you know, of course, went through all the manuals and everything for the 61, took the tests, and got in the SIC seat with the chief pilot. He started up the engines on the S-61, put his hands in his lap and said, let's go. and it was just absolutely crazy. Never flown anything else other than R-22 and picked the thing up. It's kind of hilarious. Picked it up into a 3 to 5 foot hover like you're supposed to in an R-22.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me like, what are we doing so low?
Yeah. Bring it up.
Yeah.
Bring it
up a little higher. So pretty wild, but, you know, it's kind of crazy. In the industry, they say if you can fly an R-22, you can fly anything. And it was true. Like, even though it was completely different aircraft, twin engine, you know, you could probably fit 6 R-22s inside the S-61. The fact of the matter is I was able to pick the thing up and hover it and fly it just fine. had a lot to learn, of course, but
yeah,
you know, I could fly it. And so, you know, the fact of the matter is when you have a good foundation, you can really build on it really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a helicopter is a helicopter. Yeah. And it's so true. I've not flown anything the size of an S-61, but it, you know, it's truly, if you can fly the 22, you can almost get into anything and, yeah, and pick it up. I'm curious, just as an SIC, we've had a couple folks specifically from Columbia, mm-hmm, that have worked their way. They were hire time though, right? They got hired as an SIC at, you know, 1,000 or 1,000+ sure, hours. And I've kind of heard their experience, but I'm curious just to hear what the experience of being an SIC, what was your responsibilities? What was your role in that cockpit and how did you navigate that? And how did you work together with the PIC to create that environment?
You know, it's interesting. It really depends on the pilot that you're flying with. I flew with some pilots that involved me immensely from the startup to, you know, flying the aircraft from one place to another, allowing me to do those things. And then other pilots would just tell me to sit there, fold my hands, and you know, don't touch anything.
Yeah.
And so the ability to see that and see what kind of pilot I wanted to be like and see how I wanted to acted was probably a pretty valuable part of that. You know, but really watching, it's kind of like being a CFI. So I think there are some valuable parts of that, being able to watch somebody, you know, in the CFI world, you watch other people's mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
In that world, although, you know, of course everybody makes mistakes, you're more watching what you want to emulate.
Of course.
You know, how smooth you want to be on the controls. And especially as an SIC, you know, a lot of people get motion sickness when they're flying SIC, especially if
I've heard,
especially if you're helicopter logging.
I've heard
there's a lot of that. And so, the pilot in command can change that quite a bit depending on how they fly. And so it gives you a good perspective on, you know, how you want to operate the helicopter and how you want to work with the helicopter or against it.
I watched a show recently on HBO. I think it's called For All Mankind or something like that.
Okay.
I apologize to HBO, or Apple, I should say. And the premise of the show is this idea that the Russians landed on the moon before us. And then the trajectory of history changes and what that looked like.
Okay.
When you're telling me this and me knowing you now for, I think we talked 16+ years, I know that you've been heavily involved in the flight training world.
Yeah. A
couple deviations here and there. But it seems like your destiny almost changed fairly early, where you maybe were going to be a PIC in that bigger helicopter flying utility. Where do you think your path would have gone if that was the case?
Oh, man. That's an interesting thought. I don't know. You know, I think it's very possible I could have been successful and gone down that road and, you know, been a fire pilot in the S-61 and flown heavies the rest of my life. But honestly, the opportunity that I've had to pour into new pilots' lives has been absolutely, absolutely incredible for me. The value that I find in supporting the next generation and helping to bring up new pilots and support them along the way has changed my life. It's something that I feel really incredibly passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, this is more of a passion for you. This
yeah.
is truly what you love doing.
Absolutely.
Even at my time from learning to being a CFI to being the assistant chief, so much changed at Hillsboro. And I would say for the better. Right? Because just like anything, you overfly an aircraft by accident on an inspection, a new policy has to be placed.
Yeah.
Ways of stop gaps of just protecting the operation, protecting safety of flight.
Yeah.
What year did you start helicopter training?
So my first flight was in 2001.
Okay, so 2001, 23 years ago.
Yeah.
What does the training look like in 2001? Versus now what you guys are doing here at Hillsboro Heli Academy?
That's really interesting. You know, I think that many aspects of what we did back then and what we're doing now are the same. The fundamentals are the same. Focusing on, you know, good pilotage rather than, you know, just trying to pass a checkride kind of thing. I think that all those things are very similar. But I think, especially now, and in the industry too, I see it, this focus on making good decisions is much more prevalent. You know, I think the idea of saying no, even when it's hard, is something that we're even focusing on here at the school. As opposed to, you know, let's go out, let's get those hours, let's get done as quickly as possible. You know, we want to help the student get done in a good amount of time, but also we want to teach them when to say no, and when the weather is not good enough, and when we need to take the opportunity to say no, let's fly another day.
Yeah.
You know, when I was flying TV news, I had a peer that told me, today is going to be the most important news story that the news station will ever have. And guess what? Tomorrow will be the most important news story the news station will ever have. And it gave me a great perspective to just say, you know, yeah, like today is important and I need to fly it if it's safe. But if it's not safe to fly, then I got to say no. And I got to keep to my decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's the most important thing. I always tell people, hey, what makes a good pilot? I always say it's being able to say no.
Yeah, it's true.
Because it's very hard. There's so much mission pressure.
That's right.
Whether you're flying news, air medical, I think it's probably especially hard in like a corporate VIP, mm-hmm. flying for a wealthy individual, that mission pressure, being able to say no. And I've looked back at my time as an instructor. I've looked back at my time as a commercial helicopter pilot. I feel like I've done a fairly good job at being able to navigate that and be a good decision maker. I feel like part of that is just that I've always had a little bit of that ability. And I remember teaching back in the day that it's not maybe an innate ability for everyone.
Yeah.
So how do you approach a student and help them understand the importance of, you know, ADM and making good decisions?
Yeah, I think you start at the beginning. I think that's the most important part, is from day one, even though there's a lot of pressure to get done and get flying, I think the point is you start at the very beginning. You start teaching them good decision-making. You know, we use a flight manifest system here at the school where it talks about its, you know, flight risk assessment, but it also has other things in there like, you know, how are you feeling? Are you feeling good? Are you feeling tired? Are you feeling exhausted? Did you have good sleep? And just looking at those, and all those things kind of come together, and then you say, okay, is today the day that we should be flying?
Sure.
And just teaching people from the very beginning to focus on that a little bit and focus on themselves and think about things, because guess what? Tomorrow will come, and there's going to be another day of flying. So just making good decisions. I think it was, you know, Matt Zuccaro that said the most important tool that a pilot can have is a cardboard box.
Mm-hmm.
And he made this analogy that, you know, just keep the cardboard box. And then, you know, when you have to say no to your boss that you're not going to go fly, be ready to pack up your stuff. And, you know, that might be hard for some people because they're like, oh, I have a job, I have a family. But guess what? If something happens in the helicopter and you know, something tragic happens, guess what? You're not going back to your family. You're not coming back to the job either. So being able to say no in that environment is probably one of the most important tools that we have.
I remember kind of a push when I was instructing was this idea of like scenario-based training.
Yeah.
But it was done kind of on an instructor-by-instructor basis.
Sure.
But there wasn't any true consistency. I'm curious to hear, is there still a push, and is there things that you guys are doing here to help create scenarios in which kind of challenge and test a student in the decision-making process?
Yeah, I think, you know, most of our stage checks along the way, you know, you have multiple stage checks during your private and commercial training, instrument training. Almost every single one of them, those are almost all scenario-based. Because anyone can memorize EPs and systems, but the idea of putting it into a real-life scenario is where the rubber meets the road.
Totally.
And so almost all of our stage checks and progress checks along the way are put in that format. And you're given a scenario and you're saying, okay, like, what do you need? What do you need to go fly? What's the situation? is, you know, do you have to have a certain license, you know, all that kind of thing.
Sure. Since we're on the topic of safety and safety of flight,
yeah,
you know, I know that there's been a big push in the industry for SMS, safety management system,
yeah,
just culture. And I think a lot of companies have done a great job. I've been fortunate because Hillsborough Aviation back in the day instituted that. Yeah. So I was early immersed. And then recently at an air medical company I worked at, I felt like they had a really good SMS system. They had a great just culture. And I think the industry is slowly adapting. But there's still some operators and maybe even some schools that, you know, purchase an SMS to essentially check a box.
Mm-hmm.
I know for you and just knowing your background, especially the integral part that you played in integrating SMS back in the day.
Yeah.
I'm just curious to hear from your perspective of what is SMS and why is it so important for not just a flight school, but for operators? And how do you implement SMS here at Hillsborough?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, like you said, I was there in the beginning, helped kind of get the SMS off the ground with the company. We were one of the first flight schools to ever be ISBAO Level 1 certified, and now subsequently we're ISBAO Level 3 certified, which, to my knowledge, we're the only school that has that certification. And I think that goes, you know, as ISBAO Level 3 basically says, it's integrated into your culture. And I think, you know, this idea of SMS and checking the box, it's not really that valuable, but the fact of the matter is we'll always fail to our systems. And if you don't have a safety management system in place, you're never gonna get there. You're never gonna have the culture that you want. You're never gonna have the focus on safety that you want. Not because you have a manual, not because you have an SMS manual,
sure,
but because you really value it, you really focus on it. So as a 141 school, of course, we're not required at this point to have an SMS, but now we've had an SMS for 16, 17 years.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
In place. And, you know, you mentioned the just culture part of it, and I think that's probably one of the most valuable parts of it because, you know, if you make a mistake and you come in and you say, hey, I made a mistake, you know, this is what happened. Just culture says, great, like, let's learn from it. Let's check our SOPs. Let's check our systems, let's check our policies to make sure that we have things in place to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But, you know, the other side of just culture says if you try to hide it, you try to sweep it under the rug, you try to act like it didn't happen, that just culture says there's going to be repercussions for that. And, you know, I think it's important because in aviation, secrets kill people.
Yeah.
And you can't have that. And people need to know that they can be open and honest and bring things to light, that mistakes that were made, so that not only, you know, that can be brought to light, but also, you know, the next generation can learn from it. And I think that's a really valuable part of the SMS is throughout the generations, as you have this system in place, you get to be better and better and better, and you have better systems in place going forward.
100%. Just culture to me, it starts at the very top. I think that you have to have the very top and then the management level buy into just culture as well, because they're the ones that will be effectively instituting the just culture.
That's right.
When something bad happens and decisions have to be made. How do you approach your higher level ops team here on making sure that they're always facilitating the just culture?
Yeah. You know, I think, first of all, from the very top, from our CEO all the way down, it's a value that we hold dear, and we think it's very, very important, right? And so most of our employees that come through here, instructors, chief instructors, assistant chief instructors, they all have come through the school. And so they've actually gotten to experience just culture from the very beginning. From being a student, you know, from day one as a student, when you go through orientation, we talk about our SMS and just culture. And not only do we talk about it, but we believe in it and we put it into practice. And so it's pretty easy actually when, those people kind of grow up through that system.
That's all they know.
And so, I think it's pretty easy for them. We've heard a lot from guys that have left the school, gone to other places, and they say, you know, it's amazing. Not every place is like this. But our hope is that they can take that and take that same culture, that same feeling, that same just culture environment to the next organization that they're at.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've seen everything in between. I've seen great examples of just culture and a strong SMS. And I've seen the checked the box version of SMS. It's wildly different.
Yeah.
And it's an environment I've been in before where I was so afraid to do anything wrong because I knew I'd probably lose my job, even though there was a just culture, right? So I can speak because I was here, you know, and it just culture is for real here. In fact, I experienced even working line service back in the day. You know, I was moving a Jet Ranger, not just any Jet Ranger, but like at that time, Max Lines, like Pride and Joy, 636 Echo Sierra. And I was moving it without a wing walker, and I backed it into a trailer, you know, on the pad, and no visible damage. I don't think anyone saw. It was the afternoon, but even at that stage of being line service, I had been integrated into this culture of, hey, you got to fess up, because if you don't fess up, this could cause someone to die. You know, it's a big deal. And so, yeah, right away, I went to John Hayes' office at that time, general manager. I, you know, told him everything that happened. And they looked at it. They realized that the procedures weren't clear about a wing walker.
Yeah.
There was some retraining done, and I kept working. And talk about a powerful moment as a young person in aviation.
That's awesome.
That shaped this idea for me. And come to find out, the tail rotor gearbox had to be replaced in that helicopter. And so undoubtedly, it probably would have not been a good scenario.
But you didn't get fired.
Didn't get fired.
Yeah.
And I kept working.
Yeah.
And in fact, I worked for many, many more years. So many cool things that are happening at Hillsborough Aviation. Hillsborough Heli Academy. It takes a long time. It was ingrained in me. I was at, like I said, talking to Max recently, reminiscing about the good old days. And something that was really prevalent in my training experience was the amount of foreign students.
Yeah.
On the helicopter side, at least during my time, was a lot of Europeans, Norwegians, Germans, from France, kind of all over. Whereas on the fixed wing side, it was more, you know, Asian. And I'm curious, is that still the case to this day? Are we still seeing a lot of foreigners come to the United States to train?
Thank you to our sponsor, Robinson Helicopter Company, the choice for unrivaled safety and reliability, so you can accomplish any mission with confidence. For more than half a century, Robinson has been at the forefront of the helicopter industry. From the R-22 to the R-66 turbine, Robinson makes helicopters accessible so more people can accomplish more missions. Climb higher. For additional information, visit www.robinsonheli.com.
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's just so much cheaper to train here in the United States as opposed to Europe and Asia. You know, it's so much more affordable. And, you know, the really difficult part is even if they do have the money to do training in their home country, most places don't have the opportunity to instruct and build up hours like you do in the States. And so, you know, you go through your training in Europe, you get out with 200, 250 hours, and then what do? You have no opportunities. Just like here in the States, you know, and requires about the 1,000-hour mark.
Sure.
You know, that goes up and down depending on the industry, you know, where people are hiring. But, you know, generally speaking, like that's the number you need. And how do you get from 250 to 1,000 if you have no way to get there?
There's no way to do it.
Yeah. And so that's one of the benefits of training here in the United States, especially for people that are from out of country. To answer your question, we do still have quite a few foreign students here. It's great. We also have the ability to do their European licensing here as well.
I recently, not so recently, but one of my More recent flying jobs, I was working with a fellow Hillsborough grad, Norwegian guy. He's a little shy, so he'll remain nameless. But he was actually finally, after like 10 plus years, going back home.
Okay.
And he was telling me the process of then converting his EASA, or excuse me, his FAA, then converting it to EASA. Pretty crazy things. I mean, multiple tests, lots of money.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like a simple conversion. I know that you guys have something established now with EASA, but I'm actually pretty unfamiliar with what that means. And, you know, I think it would be kind of neat to hear a little bit more in depth of what that relationship or what that certification is allowing you guys to do.
Yeah, yeah. If you'd allow me, I'd like to actually kind of back up and talk about, like, why we even got it in the first place.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that we've always focused on is trying to help students, not just like do their training and then get them out the door, but helping them down the road, find jobs, setting them up for the next thing. And so we were actually in Europe, traveling around, and we decided to meet with a flight school in Austria. And our point in meeting with them was actually just to try to establish some sort of a relationship with a European flight school so that we could have a place to send students to after they went home, like you mentioned with your Norwegian friend. And just having this idea of, like, just give them an opportunity, give them a path and a direction. And we sat down with the owner of the flight school, Rotor Sky, and we said, hey, we want to figure out a way for our students to come home and maybe do their training with you. And he said, well, you know, why don't you just do it in the States? And that's how it all began. We actually weren't even looking to do European licensing here in the United States. We wanted to just figure out how to help them when they went home. And so we started working with Rotor Sky. And probably less than a year later, we were able to get EASA certification here at the flight school. So it's pretty cool. They can go through their FAA flight training. And as they're going through their commercial training, they start studying for their 14 EASA exams, which is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And then EASA examiners actually come here to the school. Do the check ride right here in the States, and they can get all of their FAA ratings and EASA ratings in the same course of time that it took them before, somewhere around 14 months.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to be able to do both concurrently, I mean, that's a game changer.
Oh, yeah. For many people, it could save about a year after they go home, you know. It doesn't take that long necessarily, but you know, you go home, life gets in the way, you're back with your family and friends, and you get distracted, and studying for those exams is pretty hard. So,
yeah, I mean, and the exams are kind of silly. If I've heard, you know, you're maybe talking about big airplanes and some of the exams and things like that. So, I guess I'm lucky that I never had to go through that personally. You and I both.
No.
So, have you seen that impact the helicopter school? Has that really been exciting for a lot of the European students that wanted something like that?
Oh yeah, yeah, it's great. And not only that, you know, with our partnerships with a lot of the operators in Europe, you know, we have a really neat partnership with an EMS company. HEMS company out of Germany, they get put into that program. They get a mentor. They get to talk with, and we've actually had several students be able to come right out of here and either do a little bit of flight training and then go back and start working, you know, almost right away. And so it's just, we've seen really, really neat results from this program already.
So essentially, like, you've created a pathway to an operator.
That's right.
In Europe. Is there other pathways at Hillsborough Heli Academy?
Yeah, I mean, we have pathways with companies all over the world. We have pathways with Bristow, Norway, Avincis, Spain, ADAC in Germany, and then, you know, a lot of other unofficial pathways as well, where, you know, a lot of graduates are working at places and can make recommendations or help you find that job for sure.
Yeah, that's really the cool part. I mean, I think that there's smaller flight schools that do a great job, and nothing to take away from those smaller operations.
No, for sure.
But something that's so neat, and again, I just came to Hillsborough because it was in my backyard. I didn't really research. You know, I was 18. I just came to school, right? I actually did look at Silver State, and we all know how that ended.
Dodged a bullet.
So, and that was around the time, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I got really lucky. But I would say that at every commercial job that I've had, specifically like a tour operation where you're around pilots all the time, I would say a large percentage of those pilots had connections to Hillsborough.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that was, it's an unofficial pathway in so many ways, right? Just creating that relationship, building that network. The guys and the gals that you train with become lifelong friends, and they also become like lifelong referral partners.
Yeah,
it's
true. It
seems like everyone is always willing to help each other out.
Yeah.
To get to that next opportunity. So I think that's really neat that you have that connection and those official pathways. But I think also just this idea of being able to come to a school where there's so many people that train and to create those relationships. Some of the other exciting news recently with you guys is this examination authority.
Yeah, yeah, well, really big.
I didn't even know that was a thing, personally. I think I don't know if we were talking about it in Spain when we connected or if it was even just recently at HAI, but what does that actually mean? And what does it look like in practice?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's something that we've been pushing for many years. If a 141 school can maintain a 90% or better first-time pass rate on check rides based on 141 graduations, you can be eligible for examining authority. And we held that for quite a few years, and we were able to submit to the FAA, and they came in, and it was about a year-long process, actually, of them coming in. They sent FAA representatives to do check rides. We had to get some other DPEs in to check and make sure that they were actually valid numbers and valid, you know,
sure,
graduation rates. And after the year, you know, came out on the other side with flying colors, and they said, absolutely, you guys have a great program here. And we got examining authority. And so basically what that means is when a student graduates one of our courses, they don't have to go to a check ride with a FAA representative or a DPE. We actually can submit right away for their certificate based on their graduation of our course. Which is just absolutely
crazy
for the student.
So they're essentially taking a final stage check.
They are, yep.
And once they've completed that stage check, they receive their certificate.
That's right.
That's wild.
Yeah.
So does that stage check have to be with a particular member of your staff? Is it with anyone that's approved through the TCO? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like any other 141 course. You have to have approved stage check instructors or progress check instructors. And so, yeah, one of those guys, now they did go through some specific training, and the FAA was involved to help through that process to make sure that we're evaluating the way that they want us to evaluate. But really, it's just any one of our stage check instructors is able to do this. And really, it's not based on that final stage check. It's based on the fact that our course of training leads to successful pilots. And so we feel pretty proud about that.
I mean, it's incredible. And I think the biggest thing with that is the bottleneck. I feel like as the assistant chief instructor back in the day, my only job was doing the puzzle of DPE.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Trying to get enough check rides scheduled for this day and that day to make sense for someone to travel and come do these check rides.
That's
and
right.
All the DPEs, of course, either had their own businesses or were full-time pilots. So being able to coordinate with that schedule, it wasn't uncommon for a student to have to wait two,
yeah,
3, 4 weeks. And that's frustrating.
For sure.
And it's easy to lose your, you know, disuse and things like that. It makes the check ride even harder.
Mm-hmm.
So is that for every training course here?
Yeah, so The only course that we are not currently offering examining authority for is going to be our commercial course. We have actually a reduced minimums course, so it's kind of a little bit something different, where the FAA actually approved us to do fewer hours in the training course because of our success rate there again with training students. But you can't have examining authority if you have reduced hours.
Of course.
And so they'll still have kind of a check along the way with an examiner when they go through the commercial course. But everything else will be done right here in-house.
Man, that's incredible.
And, you know, you mentioned the DPE situation. I know there's a lot of schools out there that struggle a lot with trying to find examiners. And we've always been really lucky. We're a pretty big school, so we have a pretty big pool of examiners to choose from. But I know there's people out there at other flight schools. We get calls all the time where people are waiting, you know, 2 months, 3 months to try to get a check ride with an examiner.
And yeah, it's crazy.
It makes it really difficult.
You've brought up the number 141 a couple of times.
Yeah.
And our listeners will reach out often and ask about, hey, should I train 141 or 61? And I provide them my overall kind of knowledge of it. And,
sure.
And my knowledge was fairly good back in the day and understanding, and it's kind of maybe not been so great. But I give them my two cents. With you being so involved in constructing the TCO and being a 141 program, what is your advice to students when they come and ask, should I go 61 or should I go 141?
Thank you to our sponsor, Vertical Aviation International. With 80 years of service under our belts, the helicopter industry continues to innovate. We're growing with new aircraft and technology coming to the flight line and hangar. The industry's association is changing too. Helicopter Association International, or HAI, is now VAI, Vertical Aviation International. VAI unites the industry and advocates for you. Visit verticalavi.org/benefits to see how joining VAI connects you with your vertical community. Together, let's power up.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, if it's part 61, you are really relying on the quality of the instructor. And the fact of the matter is, you could have a phenomenal instructor and do your training part 61 and just get an excellent above par, you know, training. But it's so reliant on the individual at that point. It's almost like rolling the dice. And that's the part of the 141 training that I think is really helps to solidify the quality, is that everyone's going to be going through the specific course of training. It's structured, it's organized in such a way to promote success and to, you know, get the student on the other side of the check ride with ease. And then not only that, you know, all of the instructors are 141 checked out, which means they have to go through a check with the chief instructor. They got to be trained. They got to meet minimum standards. And so you have all of those quality controls in place to help ensure that you have good quality training.
Speaking of 141 checks, reminds me of the worst flight of my life.
Oh no.
2304 Whiskey. I remember the end number.
Okay.
Remember the day. I remember everything.
Yeah.
And my checkout was with you. I had just got hired, and you know, I didn't bring my A game. You know, and we worked through a lot of things, and you know, it was to the point where, you know, Hillsborough had done such a good job at curating good CFIs, you know, from early stages of instructing all the way through. And so, you know, it wasn't my best flight, but, you know, my instruction days worked out pretty well, I would say. But I just kind of want to reminisce a little bit back.
Yeah.
You know, one of the common themes on the podcast is this idea that when you show up to flight school, it's your first opportunity of introducing yourself to the company that you may work for as a flight instructor.
Yeah.
And not that you have to be a flight instructor at the school where you trained. In fact, we've had some guests on the podcast that for this reason or that reason, they ended up instructing at a different school.
Sure.
And they liked having kind of that well-roundedness. Mm-hmm. For me personally, that wasn't an option, at least at that time. I was like, I had to work at Hillsboro. But I've talked about it on the podcast. I don't think I ever, I didn't represent myself perfect all the time. And so I feel like I was given a bit of a flyer. When you hired me as a CFI, I know it's probably more memorable for me, but do you have like early on experience or memories of this guy when I was 18 years old?
Oh man, I do. I remember I remember you working in line service.
Oh yeah,
and getting the helicopters out, fueling them up. At the time, I was flying a Jet Ranger for the news station, and,
yep.
And I always loved when I would land because I knew you'd be there.
Yep,
you'd be waiting for me and you'd be ready, which as a pilot is a big deal. And you know, I think the thing about you, even though you were young, looking back on it, you were always motivated. You're driven. You're ready. You were there. You're willing to do whatever was necessary to get the job done. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I was so excited to hire you. And, you know, even though you're a young guy, I mean, I was a young guy when I started too, but the fact of the matter is you were driven and you're focused on the goal. And that's really important. You mentioned this idea of, you know, your interview starts at the beginning, and that's absolutely true. From the moment you step foot at your school for the first time, your interview starts. And I don't think it ever stops, because there's always people watching, especially in aviation, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, even the people around you, the other students, the instructors, you know, you may come across them in the future, going forward at a job, at a career in the future. And some of the things that you're doing now at the very beginning could affect your jobs later on.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I definitely remember I worked hard. I've always been a hard worker, but I think I just had a chip on my shoulder at times, you know, and I think I feel fortunate that, you know, I was given the opportunity. And I look back at my time and, you know, the level of maturity between now and then it's might as well be a lifetime ago. But it's so important because there's still interactions that I've had, even in flight school, where I'm maybe not even comfortable maybe recommending someone on just my interaction that I had with them.
Yeah.
Not for any malice or anything like that. It just, it wasn't a great showing. So I think it's super important. We talk a lot about it. Obviously, you've hired a lot of flight instructors.
Yeah.
And you probably are continuing to be part of that process now.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at a candidate for becoming a CFI, what are the qualities that you're looking for? What are the things that you're putting emphasis on to make sure that this is the right person for the position?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, you know, when you get past your CFI check ride, everyone's going to be to a certain standard, right? You're gonna meet PTS because you pass the check, right? But attitude, drive, honesty, you know, those kind of things are crucial when you're talking about getting that job. And somebody that's going to be honest with students as well, you know. You're going to run across a lot of students, a lot of different motivations, a lot of different, you know, ways that they have to learn, or you have to teach in order to help them learn. And you got to be flexible, and you got to be patient. And so, just having the skills to fly the helicopter, you know, you pass the check ride. You're going to have that.
Yeah, they come.
Yeah,
they get better and better. Sure. Yeah, it's so interesting. I explain flight instructing like, trying to teach my dad how to use Google. You know, no offense, Dad. But he's not a computer guy. He never has.
Yeah.
And, you know, watching him finger peck,
yeah.
You know, and It's so frustrating. But if I don't let him do it, then he's not going to learn how to. And so that's the interesting thing about instructing is it is theoretically very easy to grab the controls and to do it.
Yeah.
But then is the student gaining from that? Most of the times the answer is no.
Yeah.
Obviously there's demonstration and that's just part of teaching. But you have to be able to also take that hands-off approach. You talked about this idea of being flexible. I agree 100%. I always thought that when I was instructing, I would have to be able to teach a maneuver 10 different ways for 10 different people.
Yeah.
How do you help your new CFIs kind of wrap their head around not being so limited to a box that they have to kind of sometimes think outside of the box based on the way that student is learning?
Yeah, you know, we talk about that a lot during our CFI course here. Pretty proud of our CFI course here. It's pretty involved, but we do talk a lot about the different types of learning, different types of instructing, and how you may have to change something. You may have the perfect method, right, to teach the maneuver or whatever it is, but it might not be perfect for every single student. And so, yeah, we talk about that a lot during the course of training here. So it just really depends on the person.
Yeah, it's important, and it's a skill that's also kind of honed in over your time of instruction. Yeah. Jared, this has been really fun. It's great to come back. Troutdale was where I finished at Hillsboro. I learned at the mothership, but then I worked at Troutdale, I think, for a couple of years. So to be back in the facility, to be walking around, the energy still exists. This idea of students are here and they're doing something that they've always wanted to do.
Yeah.
That's what I love about flight training and helicopter training. It's you're truly choosing a career that is just a passion.
That's right.
And so being able to walk through the halls here and see everyone getting ready for their flights and then going to the flight line, seeing all the same helicopters. Some have been painted since.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
overhauled probably several times.
Several times, yeah. So just as we kind of conclude, if there's a listener that's interested in connecting with you guys here at Hillsboro Heli Academy, What is the best way for them to connect? What are some of the steps, not just for our U.S.-based guys and gals, but also our friends in Europe or from all over the world, really?
Yeah. I would say, first of all, do the research. Don't just look at one school. I know that you just looked at one school, and I'm so glad that you did. But honestly, you know, there are a lot of really good schools out there. I really, truly believe that. In fact, I'm pretty good friends with a lot of different chief instructors and operators of other flight schools, and they run fantastic operations. So make sure you do your research, I would say that. But, you know, check out the website, flyahaa.com. Reach out to our admissions department, ask the questions. We're always willing to answer anything, help you get lined up. You know, depending on what you need, we're here. We do the full training from the very beginning to the end. We really focus on that kind of career aspect of the training as opposed to kind of the one-off, licensing. But, do the research. Go do a demo flight. Go find some place that has a Robinson R-22 or an R-44 and go for a flight and see if it's for you. That's what I would say.
Yeah. You know, the research is important.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great schools, you guys included, and you guys have been doing training for so long. Get the retro hat down here.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, Hillsboro as a company has been training pilots since the 80s.
Yeah.
So, obviously, you guys have figured something out. As we wrap up here, I think what's catching my eye is that we've known each other so long that we no longer have hair.
That's true. Yeah, we both had hair. We met.
Yep. I'm just trying. I was sitting here thinking, like, I think we both had hair.
Oh, yeah.
When we met. To our listeners, thank you so much for continuing to listen and support the Helicopter Podcast. It's given me the opportunity to come on site and have these conversations, to be immersed within these operations in these facilities and chat with people like Jarrett. The goal is to create value for you guys. So we appreciate you guys supporting and listening to the podcast. Please continue to listen, like, subscribe. Check us out on all social media platforms. And thank you to Hillsborough Heli Academy for also being a sponsor of the Helicopter Podcast. It means a lot. Jarrett, thank you. It's a trip down memory lane, and it's a great trip. So thanks for having me, and thanks for making this all happen.
Yeah, thanks for coming by.
Hey, podcast listeners. My name is Halsey Schreider, and I'm the principal broker and owner of Celicopter. Celicopter is a new-age, data-driven, helicopter-specific sales brokerage bringing helicopter listings to new heights. At Celicopter, we utilize digital positioning, paid advertising, and our large network of industry professionals to move your helicopter quickly and efficiently. Unsure the value of your helicopter? Lucky for you, Celicopter offers a complimentary market evaluation. All you have to do is contact the team today. Are you ready to take your helicopter listing from Mayday to Payday? Easy. Fill out the contact information below, and a Celicopter pilot agent will reach out shortly. Celicopter. List it, sell it, done.